Joshua is now a man totally dedicated and prepared for his task. He has witnessed the power of God in drying the Red Sea and the Jordan River. God has not changed these 40 years. He has had the assurance from God that he would be successful and his way would be prosperous. And he is prepared spiritually after having the encounter with the representative of God and being asked to remove the sandals from his feet. The children of Israel are ready for battle. Their spirits are high. I'm sure their adrenaline is running. And as far as they are concerned, they want to go up from Gilgal and tear the walls of Jericho down brick by brick. But remember, this is God's holy war. And he's going to demonstrate to them that he does not need them to conquer the land. So rather than ask them to perform militarily, he says, I don't want you to do anything. I'm going to demonstrate to you that even though you are confronted with an impossible task, humanly speaking, because Jericho was a representative city, and as such, it had been around for many centuries and was still there and was the citadel, the bastion of strength for the land of Canaan due to the nature of its construction and its location adjacent to the Jordan River. So this was to be a symbolic victory, and the children of Israel were restrained from any military activity whatsoever. Prior to the destruction of Jericho, God gives specific information regarding the spoil or the booty inside the city. The old cliche, to the victor go the spoils, is not only true in military circles, but is true with God as well. And God says, this is my battle, this is my military victory. I do not need you to help me defeat Jericho. Therefore, all of the spoil, all of the booty is mine. Reading in chapter 6, verse 17, and the city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein, to the Lord. Verse 18, and ye in any wise keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest ye make yourselves accursed when ye take of the accursed thing, and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are consecrated unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. This word accursed is the word kareem, and it really means sanctified, or as some translations put it, under the ban. It does not mean accursed in the sense that we think of something being accursed, but it means this is sanctified, it's set apart, it belongs to me, God says, it's mine. So don't touch it because the spoil belongs to me, since I am the sole victor in this battle against Jericho. As we know, back in the early portion of chapter 6, the children of Israel are instructed in verse 3 to march around the city one time a day for 6 days. And on the seventh day, they are to march around the city 7 times. They are also instructed to be totally silent. Joshua tells them in verse 10, don't let a shout or let your voice be heard or a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I tell you shout. I suspect that Joshua had his hands full simply convincing these people to stay quiet. Their blood was boiling. They itched for a military encounter and activity, and they had to humble themselves to marching around the city in total silence. I also am sure that after the third or fourth day, they began to receive some jeers and taunts from the top of the wall of Jericho. Nevertheless, the seventh day came, and they were told to shout. And when they shout, rather than having a 2 to 3 year siege on their hands, the walls of Jericho fell flat. And this was a symbolic victory, demonstrating that regardless of the fortifications put up by the inhabitants of Canaan, God could overcome these obstacles in a moment. And the children of Israel ran into the city and began to follow God's instruction and in the turmoil and the confusion and the noise of battle, even in the midst of all this, verse 22 says that Joshua instructed these men to go to Rahab's house. And in the midst of confusion and chaos, they still managed to save Rahab and her house, as they had promised earlier. Outwardly, as chapter 6 comes to an end, everything is on a very high level. Victory has been experienced. God's promise has been confirmed, and the people of Israel are ready to conquer the entire land. Chapter 7 opens, however, with a disheartening revelation. That is that Achan had acted unfaithfully in regard to the things placed under the ban, because he took some of the things under the ban, and without Joshua or the rest of the Israelites knowing it, the anger of the Lord now burned against the sons of Israel. After the overwhelming victory at Jericho, verse 2 begins by saying Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai. And you can begin to see now and begin to sense that the confidence of the people is beginning to shift from God to themselves. Because now in verse 3, they say to Joshua, there's no use to let all the people go up. Just send up 2,000 or 3,000 men up to Ai. Don't make all the people go up there because Ai is a small city. In other words, we don't need God for this little job. Neither do we need all of the fighting men in Israel. So we begin to sense now this overly confident attitude almost immediately. And not only are they becoming overly confident in their own capabilities after the victory at Jericho, in which they really had no part, but they have failed to consult God regarding the next battle, and without their knowing it, they are now under the curse of God, as are the Canaanites. So verse 4 says about 3,000 men went up, but lo and behold, the men of Ai struck down 36 of the men of Israel, and they fled from the city, and the men of Ai pursued them, and now the hearts of the Israelites melt, as the hearts of the Canaanites had melted before them. Because of this defeat at Ai, the Israelites have lost the psychological advantage over the inhabitants of the land. They are now psychologically devastated themselves. They're totally confused. They're wondering what's going on. They're wondering why God hasn't given them victory. Joshua tears his clothes, falls to the earth. But now God says to Joshua in verse 10, why have you fallen on your face? In other words, now is not the time to pray. Now is the time to act. And he says in verse 11, Israel sinned. They've transgressed my covenant. They've taken things that I said were mine, and they put them among their own things, and because of this, Israel has become accursed, and because they're accursed, they can't stand before their enemies. And the earlier assurance that they had that not a man would be lost has now been laid aside. You've already seen 36 of your men die. And it's time now to rise up, take these people, consecrate them, and find the individual who has sinned and brought Israel under the curse. This is no easy task. There are over 600,000 numbered men and almost 2 million people. I dare say that Sherlock Holmes could not find the guilty party among 2 million, nor could Scotland Yard find the guilty party among 2 million. So simply in determining who the guilty individual is a miraculous occurrence in itself. And how is it going to be done? Chapter 7, verse 14 says, in the morning, therefore, ye shall be brought according to your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord taketh shall come according to the families thereof, and the family which the Lord shall take shall come by households, and the household which the Lord shall take shall come man by man. So the Lord is going to take these groups until he filters down through all of these people and finds the guilty party. But again, I wonder what the procedure is going to be. I believe that in the Old Testament times, after the death of Moses, with whom God spoke face to face, that God revealed his will through the ephod and the breastplate of righteousness. The historical record of the construction of the ephod and the breastplate of righteousness is contained in Exodus 28, 6 to 30. And evidently, somehow, through the stones that were on the breastplate of righteousness and the Urim and the Thummim, God revealed his will to the priest or the holder of the ephod who was in his will. We know 400 years later, in the time of David, as recorded in 1 Samuel 30, verse 7, David said to Abiathar the priest, "Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod." And Abiathar brought thither the ephod to David, and David inquired at the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them?" So David is using the ephod, this breastplate of righteousness, to inquire of the Lord. And somehow, evidently, God responds through this article, because Scripture says, "And he answered him, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all." Evidently, this is the method which God prescribed after the death of Moses, because we know that Moses instructed Joshua that he was to inquire through Eleazar the priest regarding the will of God in every matter. So Joshua steps forward, and the 2 million people surround him. And if you can imagine such a crowd as this, Joshua makes the announcement that someone in the camp has sinned and brought the entire camp under the judgment of God. And I believe that Achan, the guilty party, standing out there with 1,999,999 more people, more or less, around him, felt very, very secure. But after going in and inquiring of God through the ephod, Joshua would come back out and say, "The tribe of Judah is taken." The earlier census in Numbers 26, verse 22, told us that there were 76,500 numbered men in Judah. So Achan was still pretty secure, because as the rest of the 11 tribes backed away and left the fighting men of Judah standing alone, 76,500 people is a rather secure group to be part of. But then Joshua would go back in and inquire of the Lord again and come out, and he said, this time, "The family of Zerah is taken." And the rest of the tribe of Judah would move back and leave the family of Zerah standing alone. And I think that by this time, Achan may have gotten just a slight twinge in his stomach, or possibly his palms began to sweat. And Joshua would go back in and inquire of the Lord and come back out and say, "The household of Zabdi is taken." And by this time, the other houses would back off and leave this household of Zabdi standing there. And then as the household of Zabdi went by man, Joshua confronted Achan and said, "Achan, where'd you put this stuff?" Tragically, Achan confesses in verse 21, chapter 7. He said, "I saw it, I coveted it, and I took it." And oh, how my heart goes out to this man who fell and brought disgrace and shame on the tribe of Israel. I'm reminded of 1 John 2:16, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world." And James 1:14 and 15, "That lust, when it is conceived, bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death." And Achan is a graphic example of both of these scriptures. And Joshua says, "You have troubled Israel, and God will trouble you this day." And the name Achan means trouble. And they stone Achan with stones, and they burn everything that he owns, and they burn his family, and they pile up a huge heap of stones over the place where he and his family have died. And they name the place the Valley of Achor, and it means the Valley of Troubling. What an epitaph to have on your tombstone: "The Troubler of Israel." Unfortunately, it is this same sin that people fall prey to today. the sin of lust, the sin of greed, and the failure to set proper priorities in putting spiritual things first and waiting on God to provide the physical things. Matthew 6:33 says that we are to seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added. Because if we look at chapter 8, we will see that had Achan been patient, he could have enjoyed the spoil. Following the defeat of Ai and the removal of Achan and the sin from the midst of the camp, the Israelites are told to return once again to Ai, and this time God gives them assurance that they will defeat the inhabitants of the city. But God changes things. Now He says, I'm going to use you, and the battle is going to be yours, and the things in Ai are not going to be set apart for me. They are going to be yours, because you're going to partake in the military activity. And because you will partake in the military activity, verse 2, chapter 8 says, you can take its spoil and its cattle as plunder or booty for yourselves. And had Achan simply waited until they went up to Ai for the battle, the 36 men would not have been lost. The psychological advantage would not have been lost. Achan would not have been killed for his sin. And he would have enjoyed the spoil of the very next battle, because he would have gotten it with honor in a God-approved manner, with proper priorities, and he could have enjoyed it and used it and have been blessed of God. In chapter 8, Joshua uses military strategy, and the inhabitants of the city of Ai, thinking that they are going to defeat the Israelites again, leave their city. And Joshua comes in from the other side and burns the city of Ai and defeats the inhabitants of the city, some 12,000 men and women, verse 25 says. And the psychological advantage was regained. As you recall, Joshua was given a military manual which told him that he was to completely annihilate the people who occupied the land which he was to subdue. In addition, he could proclaim peace to those cities which were far off, outside of the general area in the land of occupation. Chapter 9 demonstrates that following that initial self-confidence when they first attacked Ai in the energy of the flesh without consulting God, that this self-confidence now becomes more ingrained. They have enjoyed two military victories at Jericho and Ai. They have witnessed God's power and provision and the fulfillment of His earlier promises of military victory. But we are introduced to the inhabitants of Gibeon. If we examine a map, we will see that the inhabitants of Gibeon were located not very far away from the camp of the Israelites. By no means could they be considered a city of far off. They were certainly inhabitants of a city destined for total annihilation, because they were in the area of immediate occupation. However, to look at the craftiness of the Gibeonites leads us to believe that somehow they must have been made aware of the military manual which Joshua was given. Because verse 3 in chapter 9 says that when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they acted craftily. And this is the same word used in Genesis 3:1 when describing the activity of the serpent. But when they heard that these two military victories had taken place against two very well-known cities, they began to fear for their lives, and they knew that as soon as Joshua came across the mountains with his military force, that they would be annihilated. As a result, they set about to deceive Joshua and the armies of Israel into making a treaty with them. And the only way that they believed they could do it was to make Joshua think that they lived in one of the cities afar off. As a result, they put on worn-out clothes and worn-out sandals, and they took old bread that had been around for weeks and had become dry and crumbled and moldy, and they put worn-out sacks on their donkeys, and they took cracked and worn-out wineskins, threw dirt on themselves, and no doubt gave the appearance of having traveled for weeks and maybe even months. And in verse 6, they come panting and dirty up to the camp of Joshua, and they say, "We have come from a far country. Now please make a covenant with us." And Joshua is a little bit suspicious, but they said, "We are your servants, and we also have heard what the Lord did for you in Egypt over 40 years ago. They said in verse 10, "We're also aware of your recent victories in the Transjordan over Sihon and Og. And now we just lived a long way away, and we wanted to come down here and make a treaty with you." So Joshua, although suspicious, looks at the wineskins and looks at the moldy bread and looks at the worn-out clothes and the worn-out sandals, and they say among themselves, "These men are right. They must have been traveling for weeks and weeks and weeks, these poor people. We'll make a treaty with them." And verse 14 says that after they examined some of their provisions, they did not ask counsel of the Lord. And this is the first indication that we have of direct disobedience on the part of Joshua from the earlier direct commandment given in Numbers 27, verse 21. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. Immediately following the treaty which was made, verse 17 says that they set out to continue this central campaign to conquer this middle part of the land of Canaan, and they found out that the cities in the middle part of the plain were cities which also contained the city of Gibeon. And when the truth of this fact came home to them, they suddenly realized that they had disobeyed, that they made a treaty with people that they were supposed to destroy. And in verse 18, it says the sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them. And now they began to grumble against the leaders, including Joshua himself. But they, again, reiterated the fact that they had sworn to these people because of the Lord, and they cannot touch them, because they knew that if they touched them, God's wrath would come down on them because they had made a covenant in the name of the Lord. But he says, "Even though you have deceived us and we're supposed to kill you, and now we cannot kill you, we will make you hewers of wood and drawers of water for the entire congregation." But I suppose in the minds of the Gibeonites, being servants and slaves was still better than being dead, so they were happy to do this. And verse 24 gives the testimony that the Gibeonites gave for their deception of the children of Israel. One thing that we will observe as we go through the Old Testament is that commitments that are made in one time period, which are against the will of God and are a result of not conferring with God regarding his counsel in the matter and his will in the matter, always result in some later penalty which must be paid either by that individual or by individuals in a later generation. It is the principle of sowing and reaping. When sin is sown, something must be reaped later. And we'll learn in Hosea that it is a sow the wind and reap the whirlwind, so that the reaping is always in greater magnitude than the sowing. This is a New Testament principle as well, that when we sow sin in our lives, we must reap the results of that sin. And it may be that even our children or our children's children may have to reap what we have sown. The treaty that was made with the Gibeonites was made outside the will of God and was made without the counsel of God, and it was made in the energy of the flesh through an overly confident attitude. As a result, God honored this covenant which was made outside of his will. But we will discover that over 400 years later, innocent people paid the price for this earlier covenant which was made. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 21. Beginning in verse 1, "Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, 'It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites.' And the king," that is David, "called the Gibeonites and said unto them," now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, "and the children of Israel had sworn unto them," Remember, we just read that in the book of Joshua. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. And this was almost 400 years later when Saul attempted to do this. Wherefore, David said unto the Gibeonites, the progeny of these earlier Gibeonites with whom the treaty had been made, what shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of the Lord, that is, the Israelites? And the Gibeonites said unto him, we will have no silver nor gold of Saul nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. And he said, what ye shall say, that will I do for you. And they answered the king, the man that consumed us and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, that is Saul and his attempted genocide of the Gibeonites. Verse 6, let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul. So David makes his selections and turns these individuals over to the Gibeonites. Can you imagine their response? They are going about their business day by day, totally innocent. And suddenly David comes up and says, you're going to be hanged today for what Saul did because of a treaty that was made outside of the will of God almost 400 years ago. And the man would have to say, how does that affect me? And David would just say, that's too bad. You're going to reap what somebody sowed 4 centuries ago. I believe that if someone could have stepped forward to Joshua and says, Joshua, stop. Do you know that because of what you're going to do here, people will suffer 400 years from now because you are acting outside of the will of God? And I wonder if we stop to consider day by day what the end result is going to be of those things that we become involved in. But because Joshua and the elders acted impetuously and did not seek counsel of God, innocent people would suffer centuries later. And in the very next chapter, Joshua will find himself in the embarrassing position of having to come to defense of the Gibeonites whom he should have destroyed. Because when the other Amorites discover that the Gibeonites have turned coward and made a treaty with the occupation forces of Israel, they gather their armies together to destroy the Gibeonites. As a result, in verse 6, the Gibeonites send emissaries and say, do not abandon your servants. Come to our aid because the Amorites are going to destroy us. This is the end of number 5.